Hello, we're here.
Hello. Yes, we're over here and y'all are over there. Sorry. I shouldn't open with a Chris Chen reference. That's terrible. But yes.
You've already given it an incredibly cursed energy already.
I have given it a very cursed energy. But I'll tell the people to refresh because sometimes they need to refresh. But yes, hello and welcome to our Monday stream. Welcome to Technically Evelyn's show, as we're
Yes.
calling it, since it is technically your show.
I have organized all of these at least, and generally tend to do all the stream stuff for them, so I do at least have some responsibility. And it was also me that has allowed to rope in this evening one of my favorite frog friends, Mr. Panama Hat.
Yes, welcome.
Yes, thank you very much for having me on, and good evening, everybody.
Friend time. I'll do
Peak friend.
the normal YouTubey stuff. If you want to ask some questions, the best way to do that is through our donations. We will read the chat when we're not complete Czech snorkelers. But if you want to donate to us, the Streamlabs links are the best way to do it. That is the pinned comment and also in the description. We are still monetized on YouTube by some miracle of nature, so you can become a member if you want to support us month to month, or you can send a super chat if you don't mind YouTube taking like a 30% cut, which they do. Apart from that, we do have the links down below. I don't know, Evelyn, if you've put Mr. Panama Hat's
I
links in the
have,
description or not.
actually. I
Ah,
watched
yes.
his video on Yukio Mishima earlier on and rather enjoyed it, to be honest.
Very good. Thank you. Yes.
Is
Oh, there
someone
we
I
go.
should
Yep.
I get oh was this a phrase I use so many times now, but it's someone I should probably know more about than I actually do. Someone I think the comments was recommending, was it Mishima, A Life in Four Chapters or
Oh,
something?
it's a wonderful film. Yeah, that's one of my absolute favorites. Lots of the clips in the video were. Oh, hello.
Yep, still here.
Oh, we're still going. Yeah, lots of the clips in the video were from that film.
Ah.
Very and it's sort of it's not like I wouldn't call it an art film, but it's sort of it portrays various scenes from his life, but also from his novels. Because sort of he drew a lot on his own kind of psychology to write those novels, which are very, I mean, even if I'd recommend it to people, even if you're not a fan of sort of novels as such, just the prose itself is so beautiful to read, even if you don't really care about the story as such. It's just very, very finely crafted pieces of artwork, those books.
He was also an early buy into homo fash.
Yeah, very much homo fash. He had a private army of right-wing students with whom he attempted to stage a coup towards the end of his life, immediately before, in fact.
Is this like Nick Fuentes' Catboy Army?
No, this is a lot. This is leagues above the Nick Fuentes Catboy Army, I'm afraid.
But yes, Mishima is pretty wild, although I will admit to not having read anything of his in its entirety. I've mostly been fed excerpts by certain people, but it's.
I will shill as a starter sort of aperitif for Mishima. If you find a Substack called Barbarization a la Japonaise, which is a Substack of somebody who translates Mishima's he wrote sort of short stories and essays all the time that have not been translated, and this guy is translating them for free on Substack, and he translated recently a brilliant essay called Discourse on Misogyny, where Mishima basically just like he just very, very elegantly in his own language tells women to eat shit.
Is he doing the woman question?
He is. He deals with the woman question. He says that he wants to take all female members of the Japanese parliament and throw them into Tokyo Bay. So yeah.
He's very Schopenhauer pilled.
He is. Also, despite being a raging homosexual, he had an arranged marriage to with a wife, and he had two children, who are still around now, as far as I'm aware. And they actually will sue you if you say that Mishima was a homosexual in Japan.
Really?
Yeah, they will. That film I was talking about, it's never been released in Japan because it has scenes which depict his frequenting of gay nightclubs and such.
Is that just a verboten topic then? Have they formed some sort of like litigious company? Have they got the Mishima Zaibatsu?
They've got the kind of Mishima the estate, if you will. Despite the fact that everybody knows, like, he was an open homosexual, pretty much. And he himself would write about it. You know, if you mention he was a homosexual, they will sue you. So
he's like reverse George Michael.
That's a good way to describe him. But
yeah.
Well, that's enough preamble, I think. Shall we get into the actual topic today? Because I know people may have some slightly different ideas of what we're doing than what we're actually doing.
Yes.
The tagline I put was, we're taking a break from owning the libs to define the libs. But there's a huge amount of talk about liberalism and how bad liberalism and liberalism bashing. But there isn't really a lot of definition, I think, from this corner of the internet, solid definition about what liberalism actually is, especially when it comes down to the fundamentals of it.
Yeah. I think as well that there is no real appreciation for how much of a big part it played in a number of the aspects of things we look back on history to, you know, the part it played in creating those things and providing the conditions for those things.
Hmm.
It's a useful one, and it's as the first thing I think you put in the document here. I think liberalism was really defined post hoc.
Yes.
The joke I made off air is that people think of liberalism like they think of capitalism. They think liberalism came fully formed from the mouth of Locke, you know, from people who've read Loki. Just like they think that capitalism and the market was invented by Adam Smith. It's kind of like how people talk about Sir Isaac Newton inventing gravity.
Mm.
It's that kind of thing.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, the it's essentially Hopper and the... I should remember the name of it now because I did two bloody videos on it. The quest, or the grand quest for libertarian narrative history or whatever. He sort of stipulates that one could really look at the entire period from about 500 AD to about 1500 AD as the actual period of liberalism as it existed in the world. You know, and he uses the phrases at the time, you know, he discusses the handwork of some sort of thing and the mundwork, and that was the world within which the handwork of liberalism existed, the physical action that created a liberal world order, and the way that people who, you know, look back on scholasticism as the tradition that Popper is ultimately drawing on. I mean, that whole period he's discussing there is a sort of period of, I think, what you could fairly refer to as Latin Christendom. I can hear Sargon reeing from here already about the fact that we're sort of already steering down the line of looking at liberalism never through, or not, sorry, but not through the typical Protestant universalist lens where you just debunk it and smash it to bits, but the more subtle and kind of nuanced Catholic scholastic version of liberalism, which, again, I think there's something that so much can be learned from and appreciated of. And you know, I'm someone that I should probably spend a lot more time reading Aquinas than I really have, because I think I forget how much that people like Rothbard and Mises are still really, as much as they are writing in a modern context, are still deriving stuff that goes right back to someone like Aquinas.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you could make the case that, I mean, he, like, especially in the modern world, I mean, if you go and study philosophy at a modern university, I mean, you'll learn, like, you won't learn Aquinas at all. As far as they're concerned, philosophy started with Descartes in the 1600s, which is absolutely criminal idea, because that's why everybody that comes out of university with philosophy departments is so pos in one way or another, even if they're technically right wing. Because they have no education in anything that came before the modern era, you know.
Yeah.
they have no kind of true metaphysics, if you will.
Well, see, that was,
I mean, and as you say, Aquinas is, you know, very much a powerhouse of the, obviously, the Christian side of philosophy, but also just more based, if you want to call it that, strands of philosophy in general.
He was also very, very influential on the foundational elements of the British university system when it comes to like scholarly, when actually being a scholar in Britain meant following a Thomistic tradition. That's really how it all got started. That's where a lot of the kind of prestige of the British education system came from, was that it followed this, you know, Thomistic scholastic tradition. And it was hugely influential over here. And that's what really gave birth, when we talk about quote unquote the Enlightenment and all that in Britain. It really gave birth to the period of, you know, the late 17th, early 18th century in which these things are being described. You can't have one without the other. I mean, I touched, not to again shill myself, but I touched on that very heavily in the speech that I did at the Shieldings event. I talked about the fact that you can't see history, you can't see liberalism, you can't see, you know, things like Hopper's paleolibertarianism without having that through line right back into really kind of the mists of Albion, really, when you look at the British tradition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you have this contiguous line of thought from antiquity, filtered especially through Aquinas picking up the classical, you know, European tradition, and then that being passed on to what we, you know, what modern people would see as the liberals in the 18th century.
Yeah.
Well, no, I was going to say that you can basically sniff out very quickly the people who have made it to a reactionary position and have read scholastic materials before they got there, and then got, or the people who ended up in a reactionary position and didn't read that stuff first. Because they are so much more, I feel, likely to just adapt themselves to, as you pointed out, a lot more modern and modernist sort of text. I mean, the people who have a massive focus on like all the different German idealists strikes me as, you know, you're basically trying to read everything that isn't liberal theory because they have some preconceived notion about it that it only exists after Locke, or it only exists after Adam Smith. Mm-hmm. That whole big period of history where lots and lots of great things happened and there was a world which we could look back upon and actually draw things out of, you know, that was liberalism. As I'm saying, the point from Hopper, that was the handwork of it, the building of it. It didn't require to be ideologically, you know, presupposed upon people for the system to work. They just lived in what they knew in some basic form as God's law or natural law, and that was kind of all that was needed. It was sort of common sense, but in a much more transcendent form.
Yes, indeed.
I'll interrupt this. We do actually have a £2 super chat there from D's Bit of Rough. He says Yukio is based on women, but he's not Mr. D, and there may or may not be an uwu there to completely bring the tone of the stream down.
Extremely ribald.
Well, actually, it's funny. It's funny that you should mention that, because I tried to make the argument to Mr. D the other morning that he is just the British Mishima.
Yeah, he kind of is.
I mean, if you think about it, he hates women. He's an artist. He has a preference for men, and he has an army of like right wing young simps that will like follow into the grave, I presume.
In certain ways, he's possibly even slightly better. He is Yukio Mishima with a body Yukio Mishima wish he had.
Well, I mean, Mishima was pretty ripped by his midlife.
Was he not quite short, though? Is that not part of the whole thing?
I don't know at all. I mean, he was Japanese, so I'm going to assume given that Mr. D is an absolute giant, I doubt Mishima was that tall. But again, it's relative, isn't it? In Japan, maybe he was considered a tall boy. I don't know.
I think if you asked him if he wanted to be 6'6", he'd probably say "fuck yeah" in Japanese or something like that.
Okay, so Japanese men of that era were generally of a shorter stature, though, simply because of the diet that they had.
Yeah, but, living up in the interwar period, I'm sure that was homely.
Yes. The ideas of liberalism as an older tradition, you're right, I think would cause a lot of people to if you look in the modern sense, when you look at how liberalism, I know you just spoke about the way people come out of university when they study philosophy, but if they study politics, they will see liberalism as a product of someone like Mills. They'll be taught essentially Benthamite utilitarianism as liberalism.
I mean, the kind of issue that sits above that is that they see it as basically the only acceptable system. That they're not really ever given there's always this kind of subversive idea in the way we teach political science in the West, which is that basically you have liberalism, which is the only good system, basically kind of liberal parliamentarianism, and then you have all these other ones which are kind of sort of failed, but we have to learn about them because they happened, that's the impression I get anyway. That's the process in most people's minds.
That's some very, very aggressive typing there.
Firing a machine gun into the wall there.
Evelyn has not got used to the mechanical keyboard yet with the light touch red switches and just attacks it. I put it in stream resources, but a lot of people's versions of history is this atheist meme. I think this is one of the worst things to happen to like education or like just people's minds in general, is that this is how people actually like, this is what atheists actually believe. Should be flashing up on screen now. They believe that really the height of medieval Europe, the period of, up until about the 1500s, when what they were doing was essentially creating by the day's standards, like almost like a miracle post-scarcity society through the division of labor.
This is one of the most like shockingly disingenuous, inaccurate, and disgusting like things I've ever seen. But I mean, I've seen this around for a few years now. It doesn't even really make historical sense because it assumes that scientific advancement is linear. Which you're assuming that technologies are not like varying all over the place anyway. The idea that it's like an advance, this assumed idea that it's just all progress, that technology is progress. I personally don't see the industrial age as being progress. I just see it as being the subservience of man to machine.
It's replication, not innovation, in a certain sense.
Exactly.
I do like the fact that the as you say, the common narrative is like this bit to this bit, the whole grey Christian Dark Ages. Ooh, it's the worst period in the worst period in history. And Hopper's just like, yeah, this bit was meant. We should be like this.
But it like anybody who would look at this and go and agree with it clearly just doesn't know anything. About what the Christian dark ages were like, or anything in general. I mean, also, I imagine that the person that put this together was probably a leftist, and it's a very very Eurocentric.
Yes,
it is. It doesn't take into account any of the discoveries being made in Asia or the Middle East. I mean, obviously, it mentions Egypt, but it's doing that as a part of Western stuff.
The big thing here is that it is really kind of like the Whig view of history writ large. This is the way that most people view history, and that's kind of the problem. Again, when we're talking about a liberal tradition that is older than the quote unquote Enlightenment, you have an uphill battle with people. You have an uphill battle with their own definitions. I think this is sometimes why this discussion goes nowhere. Even in, explicitly right-wing circles. Because, I mean, the elephant in the room is that the Americans have the worst idea of what liberalism is.
Yes.
Because they use the word differently.
I think we can just shorten that to the Americans have the worst ideas.
Yes.
Oh, the Americans are the worst. Sorry. Sorry, Radlib and fellow Americans. But that doesn't mean everyone's the worst on average. It just means that the extremities at either end are a bit far out for my liking.
I mean, I did recently write a 7,000 word article called "The American Disease," but that's kind of part of it, in that they have an idea of what is quote unquote liberal that is a very born yesterday idea, It is. Mm-hmm. It's not really. Oh, there's Radlib. Is that Radlib? It is Radlib.
Yes, yeah, that's Radlib. Hello, Radlib.
Thank you there, Mr. I'll read that in a second. But they have an idea of liberalism that is compounded and molded by the fact that they have a country that is only 250 years old, really. And they, as much as we struggle here in Britain to view things kind of pre kind of Tudor as not the Dark Ages, in quotes, they have a very, very hard time of viewing anything that is pre-American Civil War, really,
yeah,
as not the Dark Ages. They have like a twin birth of their ideas that is 1776 and the 1870s.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Reconstruction era and the Revolutionary War, and that's really where their mindset lays. And I think that's part of what you see here, is that because they have to live almost in like the constant now in terms of ideas, there's almost like a tabula rasa thing with American philosophy that they have to, you know, they have to buy into this like turbo Reddit version of the Whig view of history, because they, mm-hmm, to believe anything else is to realize that essentially they live in like an infant country without a culture.
Well, no, they have all the trappings of liberalism, shall we say, without the most important part, which is some form of representation of the literal God King. I mean, I think I would see it as unfair, really, to discuss liberalism without thinking about the fact that it was a set of ideas that was concurrent with monarchy, not with parliamentary democracy or social democracy as it really is now in that sort of sense. Mm. That, you know, to even hint at universal suffrage and the mass managerial state is anything approaching, you know, even the absolute monarchies of the 14th, 15th, 16th century, whatever, is just completely out of the line to me, really. And yet that seems to be, people are pretty happy to make that assertion day in, day out, that these two things are interchangeable somehow.
I will read Radlib's super chat there. Thank you for the $5, Mr. Radical Liberation. Good recommendation. He said, I would recommend How the Catholic Church Built Western Civilization by Tom Woods as a curative for this kind of ignorance of the Middle Ages. I think I have a PDF somewhere, and I think I might have actually nicked a bit of that at one point. But I've not read, again, it's one of those things I've magpied bits from and not read in its entirety, so I should probably fix that. Tom Woods, How the Catholic Church Built Western Civilization, is a very good recommendation there. Thank you for that. It's very relevant. Mm-hmm. Klimk.
Yeah, so sorry about that. I'm going to go and turn that off. It's a heater I've got on.
Oh no, it's fine. It's not too bad.
It's starting to annoy me. I'm going to deal with it.
Some slight dead air there, but Evelyn, help move the stream on. Give us the content.
No, I just think that, you know, you can't talk about liberalism as any form of serious set of ideas without discussing the implications of both Christian and sometimes more specifically Catholic metaphysics and the fact that it's centered around some form of monarchy, not a pure parliamentary democracy.
Well, it's centered in two things. It's centered in sovereignty of a divine or divinely chosen being in many ways.
Mm.
And when you look at liberalism, it's predicated largely, you know, I know Locke tried to have it both ways.
Yeah.
But it's predicated largely on the idea of natural law and divine sovereignty and the idea of a natural state of things as a higher authority in of itself, or as completely attached to a literal God. And then add to that, you have liberal theory being focused on the decentralized interpersonal organization of people and the idea that, you know, the people exist apart from the state, as it were. People exist apart from the government. And I think that it's almost a reactionary idea when Locke talks about it, because he is reaching back when you talk about the homesteading principle and original appropriation. He's reaching back really to the civilizational times of Europe, because even in those days in Europe, there wasn't much land going unused because you had to feed people. Mm-hmm. A lot of the land going unused was unusable. So what he's doing is he's talking about it's almost Locke being reactionary when he talks about things like original appropriation, because he's reaching back to a time before the king, mm-hmm. and he's really reaching back to the days of, you know, natural patriarchs and aristocracy. That's where his ideas are centered, and it's those two things together, I think, that give us the power there, because that's a lot of what Locke talks. So a lot of what Hopper talks about is very much based in the idea of the organizational world of an aristocracy coming out of the natural extended family of the patriarch, and that is an idea that's antithetical, you know, is it completely incompatible with quote unquote modern liberalism.
Well, yeah, I think you can look at it in another sense through the point we might look at later from Alul, whereby society in that period was developed enough that there was techniques to do things within society, but there were no techniques explicitly stipulated for the organisation of society. And that maybe liberalism, in a certain sort of sense, best understood, is that period of time within which you have organised society, but not an organised society.
Yeah.
If that makes any sense, whereby there really is no central body of it. And I mean that in the sense of, not that there wasn't authorities that were central to some component of land or people, but there was no central body of knowledge about how to organise the whole thing consciously as an entity. Which is, you know, the point in Gottfried, the point in Burnham, the point in Francis and many other people, is that when that's your tipping point whereby liberalism really is no longer possible, because it could never live up to the constraints and the conditions imposed upon the sort of technical necessity of organising a mass society. I mean, that's why I stipulated in my Nomos speech about Lenin being one of the key instigators of social democracy, and in a certain sense he was really one of the first people to pioneer the techniques of operating an entire state as a political entity all in one go.
Mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts, Mr. Hatt?
Well, I mean, I'm thinking about the points about it being kind of organized without being organized, you know, in that sense. I mean, the big, what really begins to look ominous about kind of Lockean philosophy, at least, is that you get this idea, well, I guess, I mean, this kind of predates Locke, I suppose, this is more of a Hobbesian idea, but this whole thing that, you know, everybody is a citizen of the state, I think it's a far larger assumption than we today give that credit for. Because that would not have been considered really to be a true idea prior to that, because you weren't really a citizen of the state as such. You were a subject of the monarch, but even then you had kind of other obligations, of course. You were a servant of God, you know, you had loyalty to a liege or a vassal or a lord. You may have had your own sort of fiefdom that you had to look after, even if that was just a household with a few servants and your own family. You know, I think that the issue with liberalism is, again, it kind of assumes all power to the state, in a subtle way, even if it doesn't seem like that. You know,
well, it's more like you start with a process of ever greater organization. And that just, you know, that alone, without any moral or political apprehensions, inevitably starts the process of someday at some point realizing, well, it can be argued that we should all just put it into, you know, authority should be bestowed all upon one place. And I know that's where you kind of end up with, you know, the writers are attributed to the theory of absolutist monarchy, because to some extent that's where they get from. But mm-hmm. the thing I always found sort of interesting from someone like Filmer is that he is annoyed with them because they get there via the position of popular consent. And I think that starting to look at it in the way that he's looking at things, where he is so innately tied to this idea that the world is always just ruled by absolute monarchy in some sense. It's just whether or not about how honest you really are with the populace about how you function it. And it, I don't know, it's a sort of bizarre contrast, really, that it's such an old world idea, but it gets us to such a prescient new world conclusion about, ultimately, elite theory.
Yes. And I think that you kind of hinted at it there, but it is, in a sense, it's a system which I think is based on a large amount of demonstrably false lies, or kind of illusions, or sort of smoke and mirrors about the nature of things. I mean, I think this is especially true if you look at societies, well, perhaps, I mean, really the only society, I suppose, that was founded explicitly on kind of Lockean, I suppose, radical principles around the time that they had been developed or not long after, which was, of course, the 13 colonies in America when they became the United States. I mean, basically, despite all the theorizing and the kind of the disagreements between the kind of Hamiltonian versus the Jeffersonian, etc., the issue you have is that, you know, there's you can give a society to liberalism all you want, but there's only one set of laws, and those are the natural laws of God. That's the natural hierarchy, and the kind of there's a certain falsity that we have about the way early liberalism worked and the way America worked, especially this idea that it was, you know, we have this assumption that it was a successful experiment. I mean, I don't think it was. I think it had failed the minute it started. We talk about how elections tended to be, of course, the most recent election was rigged, but I mean, elections were being rigged in all sorts of ways, from sort of like the foundation of the states all the way up to sort of like 1930, you know.
the myth of the free and fair election, yes.
Exactly, the myth of the election. The fact that it was always a machine polity, you know, two parties. The fact that, there was always a kind of pull towards the central state, no matter how much they talked about the decentralization of the states. Because, I mean, of course, to me, decentralization is perhaps the most important aspect of a state I could admire, or a society I could admire. I mean, yes. But the example I use is not like something like the United States, because they have this contradiction where they want decentralization, but they also want kind of liberalism and kind of universalism. And I don't think the two gel, and you will always get that pull towards the central state.
We have had another super chat, though. I'll read it before it gets a bit too old. It has been there for a little bit. Mr. Glow in the Dark donated $10 and said, Christian Dark Age was more about the collapse of a major power and its consequences. Example, Brundage collapse. Guess the Christians had to preserve and make a foundation so other people could advance. I think that a lot of that, though, is to do with the extremely Rome-centric version of history people push. Yeah. And there's this extreme Romophile stuff that goes on. And the quote-unquote collapse of Rome as a contiguous being is seen as the greatest disaster to ever befall the world ever. Really, it was kind of a slow transition to a different phase. But
I am slightly worried that people have come on the stream and they think that we are saying this graph is correct.
No.
I just want to stress we aren't doing this.
This is why Evelyn, I've got a better image so we can get that terrible graph off the screen.
All right, fair enough. That'll do.
Just to wrap up that point, the kind of decentralization I look to is the early Christian style European society. I think it was almost perfect in the way that you had all these kind of local entities within local entities, all technically loyal to, say, the Holy Roman Emperor, or to a faraway monarch, or to the Pope. But realistically, they were essentially independent, and they remained loyal through immaterial means. You know, they remained loyal because it was honorable. They were duty bound to give their due to the emperor, even if they didn't even know, you know, where the emperor was or what he was doing. You know?
That level of deception you're talking about, though, in early American sort of founding, I think much of that is just a product of loyalty being bestowed in the people, quote unquote. And that because it wasn't bestowed in God, or it wasn't bestowed in the king, then there was actually no measure for account. The only measure for account was the when some other part of the body politic acting as the people in accordance decided to get rid of you as some sort of part of a minority that they didn't want ruling anymore. And I think you can see that a lot of the stuff that I think really caused a lot of the failures and some of the foundation of America and everything all around it, despite the issue of not having a monarchy, is just the fact that they were all sort of ever so slightly power hungry, and as much as they wanted to be good, loyal men in the eyes of God and the American people and whatever else, they did all just come at each other's throats politically for decade after decade, as you do in Republican political situations.
The issue with a kind of system like America's and the system that they've kind of spread across the world is that with these kind of utilitarian liberal ideas, you have to pretend that people are fundamentally good and that government is a kind of tame, benevolent idea. The reality is it isn't, and it never will be. This is why I'm such a fan of mafia and gangster-related media, because a lot of the time, the good examples of that genre, they're not really about the mafia. They're kind of Shakespearean or perhaps Greek tragedian lessons about feudalism and power. Essentially, this may sound like I'm criticizing it through this, but this is just because it obeys the laws of power. Feudal monarchy is pretty much just the mafia, or the mafia is a smaller scale form of feudal monarchy, in my opinion. I mean, this is the reality about how power is shared, you know, and how power works. You have powerful men and their families and their associates and the agreements they make with each other. I mean, and this is the same in America. This is the same in a society that pretends it's ultra liberal and revolutionary. You know, this is just what power is between humans. I mean, it can't be any other way. And, you know, this is why in America, you've never really had what you could call genuine democracy, because the elites, because you can't have that. You can't have a system that unstable, because you need power, you know? If you're a political family, if you're the Adams or the Tafts or the Roosevelts or the Bushes or the Clintons, you can't trust a system that may actually just, like, you know, vote you and your entire clique out of power somehow. Can you? You've got to be entrenched in some way, because otherwise you can't rule. You know, and of course we can make particular bad examples of those names, but all political power, in my opinion, is passed through families. It's passed because a human lifespan and the time you spend in office is simply not enough to do anything of note, I don't think. I mean,
well, that's how it works, as a function of gatekeeping, not even by, you know, physically excluding people. You just exclude people by the nature of the fact that you might be able to accrue some sort of power by being a member of parliament, but as you say, you will not be part of the inner clique. You know, you will not have the legacy institutions, where not necessarily the real power originates, but if you want to execute any real power within society, you will need those legacy institutions and their backing. And if you don't have that because you're not in, then you're not going anywhere.
Ergo, I can feel a Tony Soprano stream coming in our future at some point, though.
Oh,
I love that.
I think, honestly, analysis of Tony Soprano is like the last patriarch, is like the last
feudalist.
Yeah, the last natural elite.
Yeah.
He's a great example of the idea of, you know, where the vacuum is, and, you know, where essentially the state can't provide, that people have to step up.
It would be perfect, because I recently rewatched that show. So I'm ready. Yeah.
We didn't get right to the end, but yeah, me, Evelyn, and Jess did watch it for the first time, really, only a few months ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it was wonderful. It was as good as people said it was, and better in places. There's definitely some bits in like season 3 and 4 where it reaches a peak of not only just the content and the dialogue and the way it's written, but it's a very stylish show. I'd recommend it. But yeah, he's a great character study of like the last patriarch, really.
Mm-hmm.
Aurelian Natty is Caesar in chat. If Rome, or in well, super chat, sorry. If Rome wasn't the centre of the West, why do all the roads lead to Rome? Checkmate, atheist.
That's a great one.
I hated the North.
A lot of people are not so happy for Columbus. but yes, I mean, the whole thing about the sort of Roman collapse and the idea of it being, you know, the worst thing that ever happened. I mean, as you say, it didn't really collapse so much as it just kind of dissolved. And in many, I mean, to be honest, pretty much all over Western Europe, the Roman power structures and the what was the Roman Empire on a day-to-day level survived. Some of it survived. I mean, some of it's still technically there now. I mean, it's some of it just never went away. You know, you kept going and it just became kind of Christianized. That was it. That was, you know, we think of the collapse of Rome as this great dramatic cataclysm. But I think for most people, they just continued living. You know, they just kept going, and in a lot of places, authority remained stable. There wasn't, you know, we think of it as this, you know, the barbarian horde descending upon Europe. You know, sort of a slightly disingenuous view of what happened in a lot of places. So yeah, this whole idea of the Christian Dark Age is, you know, I think we've already sort of thrown that out.
Thoroughly beaten that horde.
Yeah.
It is dead, and it has been beaten thoroughly. Shall we move on to your next point there? I see in the notes, which is a very prescient point, which is the idea of the law. We're going to get very, maybe slightly Bastiat-filled here, but there's an idea of previous to the modern age, and really the liberalism, especially the liberal democracy, is a 20th century idea. It's a 20th century affectation when we think about, you know, the sacredness in the abstract of the state's law rather than the idea of, you know, natural law or the traditions or, you know, the law is something static. The law is something ever changing, ever evolving, and constantly being redefined is a very, very modern idea. And the canon of state law versus, you know, God's law or natural law is a very important part of the bastardization of liberalism, because liberalism, even, you know, even the Lockean sense, is very much not based around that. The fact that it's explicitly antithetical to that. If you look at, again, to talk about Bastiat, his whole thing is like, if we have just laws, if we have a just system, if we have just judgments, and all the people agree that they are just, why do we need to keep changing them? Why does there need to be this constant cycle of new officials and new bureaucrats adding to it and bastardizing it? So if we reached a point where the law was just, the law would become static and should become static.
Yes, there are many examples of societies with static laws prior to the liberal age that just, you know, there really isn't a need to alter them. I mean, obviously Christian societies have many examples of this. An example that was slightly longer lasting is that a lot of Islamic societies in the Middle East and Asian societies, they had these just static codes of laws that were set down like 400 years ago, and then they practically never ever knew what is just. Once you have a just law, you have a just law.
As you look at the case of like even Japan or China up until their modernization, you know, that who knows how many thousands of years that continued on for. I think
exactly.
on the subject of China, I might as well segue into some of the literature, shall we say, that we've got for this evening. I've managed to steal a bit of poetry from Cunout Leden that you might enjoy.
Ooh, Mr. Leden himself.
Yes,
I see in the chat there, Radley, we do bring up Bastiat semi-regularly. He's quite heavily quoted in our democratization series, actually. There's a whole section about the foundational nature of Bastiat and his contemporaries. And basically, it's basically us doing the whole the French Revolution and its consequences have been a disaster for the human race.
The state is the great fiction by which one man lives at the expense of another, and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Yes, of course.
No, there's just, but I don't know, we've, again, liberty or equality is another book that we've just grabbed loads of stuff out for because it's just great. But I think, am I on the right page here? No, it's next. He's basically, a large part of the book just revolves around lots of literature on democracy, really, and it's a collection of it that's just quite nicely framed. I think he starts off with, there's a bit from Proudhon, which is quite good here, actually. We have, besides, as the common expression and part of the ideas of the French Revolution and part of the demands of the modern reform movements, what's called democracy. That is, an ideology merged from a thousand different sources and highly differentiated according to the various layers of our supporters. Yet one respect invariable, that for it, the power of the state over the individual can never be sufficient. As a result, the boundary lines between state and society are obliterated, and the state is expected to carry out all tasks which society might possibly neglect. At the same time, everything will be kept in a state of mobility and indecision. Finally, certain groups and castes will be given a special guarantee of work and a living wage.
Which page is this on?
It is, if you look up page 37 and 38 in the PDF, I think it is. It will be numbered 24 and 25.
24 and 25, there we go. I put the link in the chat if you guys want to read along. So I will quickly put that there for people, just to make sure that people can read along with the literature if they want to.
It's a poem from Herman Melville discussing the entrance of Angus of Britain into China. How of the teeming prairie land, there shall the plentitude expand, unthinned, unawed. Myriads playing pygmy parts, debased into equality, and glut of all material arts, a civic barbarism may be. Man disennobled, brutalized, by popular science atheized, into a smatterer, dead level of rank commonplace, an Anglo-Saxon China, see. May in your vast plains shame the race and the dark ages of democracy.
That is incredibly based, and is also a great kind of. It's like he's looking at the camera, because there is no communist China without the British.
No, exactly. I mean, talking to Jess about this this morning, actually, because I always get sick of like the Whig Nats that simp for China because it's so illiberal and based. And what China really is, in a sort of grander sense, is just all the worst parts of 18th and 19th century Europe, you know, accelerated through it at a horrific pace, whereby you just pick up all the worst of it.
So what's the, just a purely out of interest, you said that there's no communism in China without the British. Could you go into that a bit more? Just, it sounds interesting.
Well, what happens is the British come in and the quote-unquote international community comes in and basically smashes China. They do to the Chinese world what Genghis Khan did to the Islamic world, and they make it have a complete crisis of faith in itself. When, you know, it's the era of humiliation, they call it. Yeah, the great, right. You know, the long humiliation of China is really what shatters Chinese culture and Chinese civilization, because they think that you end up with Mao and you end up in the Maoist era. And the Cultural Revolution, and them thinking that they have to break from everything traditional because they think that everything traditional has failed them British and other powers came in and just absolutely did not respect their civilization.
Something which is at the very basis of the Chinese psyche and always has been and always is that China is the greatest civilization there ever could possibly be. That is the fundamental assumption, and it never is challenged. And so that's why when the Europeans came, they didn't care to adopt any of it. And in fact, you could contrast it with Japan, who had an idea that at some point they basically adopted Chinese culture wholesale, because they basically came to the conclusion that China was the greatest civilization. And then when the Europeans showed up, they said, okay, well, no, the Europeans must be the greatest civilization, so let's just adopt them. Mm. Where, of course, China couldn't do that because it has this fundamental idea that it is the greatest civilization and there is no rival. But, of course, it's interesting because despite the century of humiliation, which, of course, as you say, you know, basically shook it to death, they never lost that. They never lost the idea that they were the greatest. So, you know, hence you get the Republican era, you get Mao, etc.
China number one.
That's exactly.
All they really kept was that weird, spiteful sense that they should somehow be superior. They lost all the artfulness. It was all kind of shook out of them. by the continual refusal of the outside world to not make China into a giant vassal area. Mm-hmm. Even the idea of China as an entity as it is today is the Europeans just came in and basically went, this is kind of the extent that we think the Han Empire was, so we'll kind of make this. Like, China like that never existed. China was always a collection of kingdoms, principalities, different peoples. They'd get nibbled on the edges by, you know, their idea of the barbarians. It was a very fluid thing, and that's really what kept China as it was during its kind of golden eras, as dynamic as it was, because there wasn't a set idea of China. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea of Han China is this retroactive thing that had to be introduced to give back some idea of Chinese identity after the century of humiliation.
Obviously, if I might, there's just continues a paragraph or two here where they keep commenting on China, just whether it's interesting or not. This vision is admittedly cultural rather than political, but neither to Melville nor to John Stuart Mill nor to de Tocqueville were the deeper interconnections hidden. Mill also became a victim of this misinterpretation of China, largely a visual error, but the analysis and premonition of this fervent, though conditional, friend of democratic values are as timely today as ever. He wrote, "The modern regime of public opinion is in an organized form, but the Chinese educational and political systems are in an organized, and unless individuality shall be able to successfully, I've completely lost it. It's such a weirdly written sentence that I've completely thrown myself off there. The modern regime of public opinion is in an unorganized form, what the Chinese educational and political systems are in an organized, and unless individuality shall be able to assert itself against this yoke, Europe, notwithstanding its noble antecedents and its professed Christianity, will tend to become another China. What is it that hitherto preserves Europe from this law? What has made the European family of nations an improving instead of a stationary proportion of mankind? Not any superior excellence in them which then it exists. Exists as the effect, not the cause, but the remarkable diversity of character and culture." I don't know, just thought that might be somewhat interesting. That he's kind of having his own dig there at the why are we actually different worlds here?
he's making the very salient point that China isn't a country; it's an area.
Mm.
Yeah, this is I'm trying to think who raised this point. It was the other week. They said that the greatest mistake every Westerner makes is to think of China as a country. It's not a country. It's a civilization.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's you can't think of it in terms of the Western nation state, because that concept is simply alien to them.
Yeah, it's like a greater form in some sense of we think of like uncontacted tribes.
Yeah,
you know they were to the 18th century that you know that big uncontacted tribe of the East that was mysterious, in the way that we look at ones that are much smaller and, you know, rarer in the jungle nowadays. But in a certain sense, that must have been the way that there would have been relations between these people. They've been a lot less than the way we think now, whereby, you know, in a certain sense, Mill is correct here, that we are a lot more like China now than we were before.
Yes.
And that's probably partly our fault, or if not, almost completely our fault.
Well, it's also the issue that you get with like the global experiment, the idea of the global monoculture, and imposing the global monoculture on these far-flung corners of the world with completely different traditions, completely different histories. You end up with these, you know, traumatized people. It's also another great example of, you know, a lot of people reach back to the British Empire and say how based it was, but it really was just a big gay globalist experiment.
Yeah.
and Cecil Rhodes was the precursor to all of this modern Faustian liberalism.
Turn of the century, George Bush.
It was all just done in the name of mercantilism and trade networks and stock jobbing. I mean, the thing about the British and the European empires in general, I think, to clarify, yes, there were heroic men who went out and did heroic things within that framework, but the framework itself stood for nothing more than the material at the end of the day.
Yes,
you know, it simply didn't. It had no greater meaning than then, well, we need this piece of land so that the French don't have it, and also we can force this inland area to start trading its gold to us. You know, it's that's really what drove it. You know,
well, yeah,
and then it was just kind of piggybacked on by politicians as this great kind of psyop of, you know, Britain is now the greatest empire in the world. You know, look at all this. It's like, yeah, but what does it stand for? You know, why does Britain own the Caribbean and parts of Africa and India? Like, why does this exist? You know, why? It's just geopolitics, trade. No.
Well, it's kind of interesting as well. You can look at the what is touted as much of the modernization of the Third World under the, you know, British Empire. Could actually just be argued as a consequence of the fact that British people at the time, even now, or even then, sorry, relative to the sort of, you know, 18th century third worlders, must mm-hmm. live such a softer, especially the bourgeois, such a sort of softer and cushier life that they thought, well, if we, you know, if we're going to rule over this place, we can't live like the people of this place.
Mm-hmm.
And it is from there that it becomes no wonder that the people who are of that place can no longer relate to it anymore, because they are ruled by someone who doesn't want to, even on just their own personal level of convenience, live in, you know, India or Pakistan or wherever mm-hmm. it is, and the way that they found it, you know, in such exactly. a simple kind of human comfort level, it leads to corruption.
This whole idea that you go and you bring civilization, it's like all you've done is bring liberalism to some of the most traditionally metaphysical places on earth. I mean, the fact that Britain entered India when it was a kind of monarchic kind of half federation of kind of warrior states and kind of the most traditional, one of the most rigid caste systems in the world. And then they left it with a Republican centralized parliament and a prime minister, you know, and the abolition of all the royalty. You know, I think, you know, if someone's going to turn and say, well, the British Empire was based, you're going to have to answer that question. It's like, well, then why was Britain's greatest legacy in India Gandhi, you know, who was a middle class British educated lawyer, you know, lawyer.
So you also have to look at the state that Britain found itself in after the imperial era. That we reached these, we are this long-running civilization that thought in civilizational terms, or at least in multi-generational terms at first. And you look at the period of the empire, it is essentially Britain setting itself on fire to achieve this.
Mm.
It comes out of the imperial era broken and ruined and subjugated in many ways.
Well,
it becomes an outpost of America.
Mm-hmm. And part of the reason that we're still living with this now, is this problem that we structured our entire society around the empire and the idea of empire. The whole, like, for example, the reason that the British public schools turned out the way they did was literally to educate bureaucrats to run the empire, you know? The way the military evolved, the way certain political ideas evolved, it was all to keep this empire going. And then the trouble is that we began to take that as just being what we do in Britain as a kind of fundamental way. And then as soon as the empire collapsed and went away, you've now got this issue of kind of an engine without a car. See what I mean?
Well, I think
it becomes self-perpetuating, yes.
It was just futile on so many levels, though, even down to like the silly stuff of, you know, in a certain sense we can look at it, you know, we brought toilets to nations that didn't know how to use them, and then when we finally spent centuries teaching them how to use them, they thought, nah, I'll still squat over a hole in the ground and wipe my arse with my hand. They don't care. Everything we take is like, you know, that, as you're saying, in some sense now the pillars of our society, because it was so, you know, almost kind of a bourgeois in a sense compared to these other nations, you know, our pillars did become things like cleanliness and like living for ages and, you know, those very base ideas of material progress, and that ultimately, you know, we're coping just for the fact that we can no longer be satisfied with shitting in a hole in the ground.
Yeah. There's a few. We're getting toward the top of the hour here, so there's a few super chats and Streamlabs donations built up. So I will quickly read those out because we have a few of them here. We have one here from IPA is Global Homo Juice, still one of my favorite names. He says, just a donation to congratulate you all on the success of the latest Nomust event. Also, Scrump, I appreciated your Senator Armstrong posting a few weeks ago. Summed up my feelings perfectly about the vapid things people still talk about over real issues. Yeah, that was me dumping on Le Slap discourse. I only did a bit of it because I didn't want to become heating the discourse as the new discourse, because that's just as cringe. But yeah, I was posting some Pensin Armstrong from Metal Gear Rising. Also, I meant to make a rules of nature joke when we're talking about natural law, but I'll make that now. Glowy donated $2 and says the constant changing of laws seems more a liberal problem due to constant redefining of things, thus disrupting people's understanding of the phrase or words. If people have the same understanding of things, very little needs to be said. That is true. It becomes definition, musical chairs, and deliberately confusing to people. Aurelian Northius Caesar, another $5 donation, says China was only ever advanced when it was ruled by the Mongols. When they took back power, they believed they didn't need to do anything, or they believed they didn't need anything. I think China became a little too navel gazing, but that's, you know, the problems of Chinese civilization are no excuse for the vassal nature of how it was treated, and then we've ended up with the reaction that is communist China, and them now doing what they're doing as a direct result of the century of humiliation.
Mm-hmm.
Again, we need to train ourselves to think on more civilizational timescales than immediate timescales.
I don't want to say that like Chairman Mao was entirely correct, but imperial forces did enslave his people with the division of labor. In a certain sense.
Yeah, well, a great example of this, actually, is the introduction by the West of the rickshaw into Asia. Because everyone assumes that the rickshaw was this traditional Asian thing. It wasn't. It was introduced by a Western businessman in the 1800s, the rickshaw. And the reason it was so kind of shocking, and the reason it works as an example, is because it's replaceable wage labor.
Yeah,
because you that person pulling that rickshaw means nothing. He's fungible. As soon as he's too tired to pull the rickshaw anymore, you just get someone else and you stop paying him. You know, and you pay the other person a pittance to do it. You know, that was the introducing that to Asia was quite shocking, because they previously were a much more feudal idea of what work was, and this kind of idea of this idea that you served somebody in particular. You know, you served a lord, or you served an order, or you served you. The idea of just, you know, as you say, basically, you know, Western liberalism and the things that we've come to develop over the last few hundred years are objectively bad to any healthy civilization. And I understand what you're saying, basically, that yeah, in a sense, the West kind of, in a sense, did introduce the Chinese to a new form of slavery via kind of capitalistic modes of labor, shall we say.
Well, I think actually...
I can hear Stargon reeing now.
I might jump, but we can come back to some of the Cunard-laden points. There is one from Elul. It's page 237 in the PDF of the Technological Society. And it's in a section where he discusses technique and economy, and he begins to discuss the naturally authoritarian nature of a technologically organized economy. And I think that some of the points he makes in it in regards to the way that law and natural law was before is actually quite interesting. An economy completely founded on technique cannot be a liberal economy. This is not entirely the same as the preceding idea. Technique is, in reality, opposed to liberalism, a social form which is unable to absorb and utilise modern techniques. It seems clear that economic liberalism is not in itself a technique. In fact, the attitude represented by laissez-faire, however much mitigated it may have become, is a renunciation of the use of techniques techniques suppose conscious human action, not abstention from action. Which is, there is a little unironically flexing that he's probably got like 190 IQ and is like a super genius. Despite the fact that he's French and I should hate him, but I can't. When liberalism requires men to put their trust in the obscure alchemy of certain natural laws, it in effect restrains them from making use of the technical means at their disposal. This means permits men to intervene in the order of nature, to adjust its laws to their purposes, and to exploit them as in the physical order. They also permit intervention that would appear to contradict natural laws and modify the order of nature. It is clear, then, that they are not really laws at all. In view of this, technique does not accord these non-existent laws the respect recommended by liberalism. Therefore, when technique develops, both the liberal attitude and its doctrine become impossible. I have posed the problem at its most acute by placing at it point of contact between liberalism and the economic techniques of intervention, which are the very negation of liberalism, but my thesis is just as true for the simple techniques of production, which influence the economy. As I've already shown, every mechanical technique supposes a corresponding organisation. An organisation is the diametrical opposite of free enterprise, and the organisational state of mind is the diametrical opposite of the liberal state of mind.
What he's basically saying is that a centralized economic organization in a totalizing sense is incompatible with human freedom and liberalism,
yes.
Or at least the traditional ideas of liberalism, which is a very salient point. And you're right. What happens is that China did have the division of labor. It did have its own economic systems, but it didn't have Western mercantilism. And that was imposed on them from outside and called civilizing.
Well, it also didn't have the best part of a millennia to adapt itself to the growing economic techniques that are predicated upon for a larger mass society. So when they were essentially thrown into a situation of having become a mass society in the space of less than a century, as opposed to almost a millennia, I think it was something we actually discussed at Nomos at one point, having a drink after the Friday or something, that mass death in China during the communist period is not per se a problem with communist ideology. It's that if you don't have the thousand year odd development and adaption to economic techniques, that communism then does this. And that's not to say that communism would work if you were perfected to economic techniques, but that its effects are less damaging over a longer period of time.
Yeah, the it's the same thing really that's been happening in places like India post-Raj. It's the same thing really that happened in Britain that ended up with the kind of Dickensian myth, as it were. It happened slower here, and there was a less degree. And if you look at the, especially the currency stabilization in Britain, the situation was a lot better than a lot of historians give it credit for, but it still ended up with the conditions as they were in the cities with this lurch, the British Great Leap Forward, as it were, that caused this period of abject human misery in certain quarters that was then seized on by the socialists as an excuse for even more rapid development. And it becomes like a self-perpetuating engine, in that the problems of the natural problems of advancing too quickly end up as justifications for even faster advancement, in quotes.
I might continue on here, actually, because I forget some of this is quite interesting. It almost goes reactionary for a minute. It will doubtless be pointed out by way of refutation that production techniques were developed during the ascendancy of liberalism, which furnished a favourable climate for their development and understood perfectly how to use them. This is no counter-argument. The simple fact is that liberalism permitted the development of its own executioner. Exactly as in a healthy tissue, a constituent cell may proliferate and give rise to a fatal cancer. The healthy body represented the necessary condition for the cancer, but there was no contradiction between the two. The same relation holds between technique and economic liberalism. Here, then, is a locus of the conflict between technique and the liberal economy, which Younger, among others, has studied. Technique is inevitably opposed to the liberal economy because the end of technique is efficiency and rationality, and the end of liberalism is money profit. Technique requires of the liberal economy non-profitable decisions and risks. For example, when expensive new machines are developed before the old ones have been amortized, the industrialist is forced to liquidate the old machines or he runs the risk of being eliminated from the market. This conflict holds good on all levels. When the state controls the economy, it faces similar problems, but such problems affect every economy. In this perspective, planning is criticised as wasteful, yet the very criticism shows that the liberal mentality is still in force. Which I think is an interesting point. You know, we are all, in the way that Mises would discuss, self-interest in a sense that we wish to develop either physical or psychic profit by going from state A to state B. And that's the sort of mode of, you know, almost task management that humans have naturally when they engage with the world. And because of that, we anachronistically look at a lot of technique through that lens, and it ultimately, you know, pre-programs us in a certain sense to be just looking for efficiency, because that same, as he's saying, the end before liberal social organization is seeking out your own end, but ultimately understanding you're seeking out your own end because you have to play your part in a community. Whereas that no longer holds as the sort of basic social condition for those who are part of, you know, a more specialized economy where there is a deeper and wider net of the division of labor with more complex tasks within it. Mm-hmm.
It's basically a law making fun of the quote unquote economic liberals going, you can't do that, you can't be traditional, that's inefficient.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I mean, funnily enough, this is a critique of this is a kind of pro capitalist thing that AA used to say all the time. He used to criticize India post Britain for its some of its attempts to kind of return to a traditional form of economy or to maintain the traditional economies that survived, especially in, of course, the vast Indian textile industry. Yes, I know that this is something that we don't, because a lot of the criticisms, of course, we face from leftists, but this is mainly from something from within our own circles that comes
up
a lot. You know? Very, very much a kind of dark horse.
I think it's a point that is completely and utterly missed, that if you have no central body for the organisation of society, then you furthermore have no central body with which to impose all of the aspects of modernity upon a society.
Mm-hmm.
You can't have the monopoly on violence without the, you know, the monopoly on organisation.
Mm.
It's a point that I make in my a little bit in my kind of American disease piece, but it's just like what if the Afghanis just want to sit in caves, herd goats, and read the Quran and not have electricity?
Want.
Yeah, like what if these people do not want to be advanced? What if the Africans just want to walk the plains and live in mud huts?
Yeah, no, they are literally in the condition of Adam and Eve. They're happy to wipe their shit with their bare hands, and they don't care. So like, let them revel in that.
Who was it that used to tell the anecdote about the African society? I think it was somewhere in West Africa. An American tire company went out there and established a rubber plantation. And they hired a bunch of local Africans who would come and harvest the rubber, and then they would get the pay at the end of the day. And the Americans wanted the employees to work harder, so they doubled the pay rate. Mm. So the Africans only showed up half the amount of hours.
Yes,
because the American company assumed that, like an American worker who just wants more and more money, these Africans were being paid an amount of money that suited them. So they didn't. So when they said, "Okay, well we're going to pay you twice the hourly rate," I'll just work half the hours then. Because there simply isn't that instinctive kind of Western jump for the higher wage. It's just, you know, we're okay.
But I think that to me seems like one of those things that people would reflexively just blame on liberalism.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is so much deeper than that. You know, materialism is a condition of modernity, not just because liberalism existed as a set of ideas. It's a whole lot more to that process than that.
Yeah.
You know, one...
It has to totally infect the minds of everybody in a sense.
Yeah. I mean, in order for it to work. In a certain sense, I mean, I always bring up Lenin, but it's just because he's a perfect example of what I think of when it comes to totalizing a society, getting an entire, you know, landmass of people to all mobilize either for one purpose or to one organization. Mm-hmm. And the way of looking at it is all mobilizing for one purpose. Edward Bernays basically did that for, you know, American liberalism, as we are told. But if you look at it in a purely technical sense, both Lenin and Bernays tasked themselves with mobilizing a mass populace. It was just that one did it via socialist methods and one did it via what we know as capitalist methods.
This is the, I think Lenin, in a sense, is the kind of logical conclusion to the liberal project. I mean, look at what Napoleon achieved immediately after the French Revolution, where he basically was able to take a state and use it as a weapon, just point it at enemies, you know, just send the entire resources and manpower of the state at your enemies, and he managed to conquer pretty much all of Europe. I mean, you know, and the whole reason behind the famous book by Clausewitz on war, that isn't really a book about tactics. It's a book about how to basically mobilize the state to point its resources at people. I mean, that is what Prussia became. You know, that's what Germany evolved into, and then all the states of Europe kind of also took this kind of revolutionary Napoleonic form. And then, of course, you just have the First and Second World Wars and the ensuing chaos. I mean, that is basically the shadow we live in. The people always kind of like to meme about this, you know, why do you reactionaries say that the French Revolution was the worst thing to happen? It's because it was the final tap that opened up the floodgate, essentially, to people being able to completely mobilize l'état, you know, the state. I should point out as well, I'm not an absolutist for this reason, because I think that monarchical absolutism and the French model was what kind of set this up in a sense. Because if you have a kind of decentralized Europe as such, you can't really do that, because the nation state as we know it doesn't really exist in that context. It's quite difficult to get, I don't know, somebody from Provence to go and fight a war for a king in Paris, you know, because the interests are sort of close but not that close. And of course, you know, you have things that unite them. You have the kind of identity. You have the Christianity as such. But unless that grand idea, the grand ultimate metaphysics of Christianity, is threatened, generally, disputes and wars remain local.
Yes.
Well, yeah, we can always maybe look at it and contrast between, you know, it was just the nature, the conditions, and the so-called Dark Ages that mobilized people, because whether they, you know, if they didn't get up and engage with basic agricultural labor, they starved to death. Whereas once you have some sort of subsistence, some sort of basic level of subsistence that is produced by the excess of industrial society, then you have to then have the form that I see always, and Radlib enjoyed the fact I made this point the other day on Telegram, that, you know, there is a subset of the right, far right, distant right, whatever, that has pure and utter adulation for Uncle H, as we might call him, purely and simply for the fact
Mr. 88, yes.
Yeah, purely and simply for the fact that he mobilized the German people and forced them through, and what you can see in the Maoist sense is the perfect mold of the National Socialist citizen. And that almost feeds all the way back to your point you mentioned earlier on about, you know, Hobbes first seeing people as citizens of the state and social contract theory, that, you know, it is in some sense is accurate to then suggest that that can lead to what you end up with in mid-century Germany. But it's not because of the nature of the ideas, it's the nature of the conditions.
Yeah, and the H-man is just another example of this. I mean, I don't really see national socialism as such is really being worthy of that much deep consideration.
Well, no one can define what it is.
No, exactly. but again, it's really just there isn't really any discernible difference in method or motivation in Hitler than there is in Robespierre.
Yeah,
you know, for example,
FDR is the good example.
Or FDR, yeah, or really Napoleon. You know, it's this concept of kind of statist, populist, kind of what would be a word this ability to pick up the state and wield it like a cannon. You know, is what I'm talking about.
It ultimately what it does is. Again, it's what Britain did with the British Empire and the British state, is you do it for short-term gain, but essentially you're setting your house on fire to keep warm. Yeah. It's not a sustainable situation. Oh. And it's a point that I make when I talk about the American Empire, and that it inevitably has to collapse. America is burning through its social and economic resources at an alarming rate, and doing so faster than I think the British even did. The British had maybe 200 years in that state. I think the Americans have only had about 100 since the 1920s of becoming the dominant force on the world stage, and they're already running out of steam. On a civilizational sense, they're speed running collapse.
It's simply at the end of the day, this is the issue that goes back to the foundation of America, but of course now it's a machine with far more moving parts, so the flaws are more evident. Is that what does it stand for? You know, it stands for these abstract words like, you know, freedom and liberty and all this kind of stuff, which at the end of the day they don't mean anything. They don't actually stand for anything metaphysical in a realistic sense. They're just buzzwords. Like the American bugman will sit there in his pod, like dying of malnutrition and being enslaved to a corporation, and going, we have freedom and liberty in this country, you know? Like, there isn't any kind of concrete metaphysical drive to it, and then there never has been, you know?
Well, that's the thing I want to bring us back round to when we talk about the period of original, you know, you define the liberal era, Evelyn, really as existing pre-Enlightenment in terms of praxis, as it were. But it's not a totalizing system. It's not a set of ideas that works in the abstract. If you look at what is considered as liberalism as a set of ideas, it lacks a metaphysics, it lacks a spirituality, it lacks a lot of things. It reminds me of a good example of that on the right is like Randians. Mm. It reminds me of Randianism, because that's, you know, despite its reputation, is a very liberal in the classical sense set of ideas. But it doesn't have a metaphysics. It's explicitly an atheist set of ideas. Well, it explicitly forbids the idea of the king, and that's really what you end up with with the modern liberalism. In that it's liberalism stripped of everything else that went around it. It's framing mechanisms, the society it's meant to fit into, the ideas it's meant to interface with. Liberalism in the abstract is the vacuous repetition of words that you're talking about, Panama Hat. Mm-hmm. It is like the Americanism of it. It is the abstract idea that you have liberalism, but you don't have, you know, the traditions of the nation that it has to apply to. That's all stripped away.
Well, almost doesn't mean anything. Yeah, it almost gets you to the point of the kind of just notion that information itself is entropy, and that anything really exists in its purest form as just action and just, you know, thought, not as conscious ideology. I mean, again, something we discussed the other weekend, the sort of notion that you could see Robert Filmer as possibly the person you could blame for the downfall of monarchy, because he's the first person who, you know, takes it and explains it all in one go and freezes it in place in a sort of sense, so that other people can then argue against it, whether rightly or wrongly. But before that explicit definition of it, though, there is, you know, the arguing of it has to be done in a purely subjective and a much more human sense, and that was very much the same case for liberalism.
I would say that Filmer. See, the issue with Filmer is that I agree with what you're saying, but the contents of his writings are correct. Mm. But just as you say, he's elucidated them, and now he's kind of intellectualized it.
Yes,
as opposed to it being an actuality. But whereas
by speaking the word of it, he's ruined it.
I think it's. I would at this point, just thinking about kind of monarchy and absolutism, I would bring up this whole issue with the word liberalism. Mm. It's obviously drawn from the word liberty. And over the course of its history, we basically lost really the meaning of what liberty is. People just keep saying it. But prior to the modern era, liberty had a very concrete idea. It was a concrete definition. And it was something that existed in most Western European societies in some way. Like, for example, the idea that the, like, British, well, not British, but say the English free man in, like, you know, 1410, for example, has various liberties accorded to him by God and by his lords, for example. The idea that the lord himself or the knight or any particular level of the hierarchy has liberties accorded to it with their standing, just as everybody does. But the idea of this kind of universal catchword of liberty just did not exist. You wouldn't have applied it like that.
Mm.
This whole idea of universal liberty is basically a spook, in my opinion. It doesn't exist.
Well, yeah, it was. I mean, this is an argument I used to have with some of the ANCAP kind of people, and I think I might as well flash this image back up because we're getting in some Hoppian talking points. But
yes,
that, you know, in the same sense that Filmer says, when did the state of nature actually exist? Like, when were you ever free? Freedom and liberty is the product of
yeah.
a society that predated you. And it's in some form of order for centuries, if not millennia. It is only because of that consistent and lasting and permanent order that you have what you can call liberty, insofar as, I mean, maybe even to tap into what's, you know, thought of commonly as the Marxist definition, but liberty from the conditions and necessities that nature puts upon you.
Yeah, I mean,
well, there's... Yeah, sorry. Go on.
I mean, this whole idea that, you know, man is born free. It's like, no, you aren't. You're born like this. This has been pointed out by people far less based than me. But, you know, it's like you're born this kind of crying, mewling infant that can't take care of itself and will die without a mother and a father to look after it. And, you know, what if you're born to, like, some family on the Mongol plains who are then immediately wiped out by an invading tribe. Like, you're not owed anything by life.
There's an even greater point. I think you could argue that the very conception of your own birth is the negation of your choice to not live.
Mm-hmm.
I remember you and other people having that argument with, like, the ANCAP people. And the people who, you know, the hardcore ANCAP, pure ethicalist. It's like, okay, are people free to not choose to be born?
Yeah, exactly.
It's like you are aggressed upon by the abstract ethical definitions of, like, I mean, the ANCAPs. You were aggressed upon by your parents because you didn't ask to be born.
in an absolute philosophical sense, I agree with what Camus said, that the only philosophical question is whether or not to commit suicide.
that's really good.
That's the only philosophical question that actually exists. And basically, all philosophy, all metaphysics, all religion is an answer to that question. It's saying no. The negation of nihilism. And of course, as we know, we're now living at a point where the only thing keeping, I think, most people from killing themselves is pretty much just consumption and material.
It's like all those posts about people getting cancer and wanting to see the next Avengers movie early because they don't want to die without having seen it. Yeah.
Don't kill yourself. My friend never got to see the end of Game of Thrones. It's like, well, Christ. Yeah. I mean, thank God he did.
I was going to say, that's yeah. it for some people, though. They have no higher purpose.
Yeah.
In a theological sense, in terms of the, you know, when was the state of nature, if you go by the Christian tradition, you could say, well, man was free when he wasn't burdened with knowledge. Therefore, yes, exactly. sentient...
When he wasn't really man.
Yeah. It's yeah. like, every if you asked, anyone who is capable of understanding the question is not free. That's what I'd say. Anyone who can think about their freedom in the abstract is not free and has never been free.
And the whole reason that I'm so keen, like, my answer to all this is just, well, you need to return to a kind of faith, is because the closest thing we can get to freedom is a kind of autonomy under God, essentially. When you fully realize what you are and then accept it, that's the best thing we can get to freedom.
This is a point I was going to get onto, hopefully, was that even someone like John Locke, again, who's lambasted as liberal nonsense, he only ever recognized that you were free under God if you were a white man. And that was how it worked. That to him, that was how you got liberty, was you were free under your recognition of God as a white man, and that was basically it.
Mm-hmm.
And as you're saying, it because of that recognition that you are not assumptively free. I mean, the tweet I had a while back that like triggered so many folk, and I thought it was really funny, was that, you know, a society that believes you are born in enslavement will free you, but a society that believes you are born in freedom, and absolute freedom, can only ever enslave you.
That's a good point.
Exactly.
It's in the abstract. It's the whole thing of there's an argument I saw again between the ANCAPs and people. I wish I could find it. I think the guy's account got suspended, but he goes on this absolutely surgically precise series of arguments where it's like, look, the only, by your definition, the only person who could truly be free is the last man on earth. And he would be free in that he could not be aggressed against by other human beings, and his interests will never conflict with theirs. But he would be completely alone and completely miserable. And he would have no bonds of family. It's the things that stop us from being free, really, that are the essential parts of the human experience, like being part of a family.
Yeah, but imagine how much time he would have for playing Nintendo Switch games.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He'd get so much. Yeah,
so much bing bing gets... wahoo.
God.
Think about that man's grind set.
I mean, to pare it down to an even more basic philosophy, I mean, I have this maxim taken from a philosopher that man is born a rebel because his own nature disgusts him, essentially. To me, what a human is this twisted halfway point between a beast and the image of God, essentially. The fact that man is cognizant to recognize his kind of bestial nature, but also his ability to move towards the divine in areas like, say, art or philosophy, is this kind of great contradiction. And if the kind of liberal philosophies that teach that man is this kind of perfect, being that is basically enslaved by other men, it's because even if you just are the last man on earth, I think you're still in chains because you're still man.
You're still
having to battle against your own desires and vices and own failings and own weaknesses in order to do anything.
Yeah, you know? the last man on earth would probably still wear clothes.
Yeah, exactly.
He'd still feel the shame. And that's the point. Yeah, that's why I don't like a lot of the transhumanist stuff so much. That's why I think it's so destructive. It's like, eventually we'll move beyond human limits, guys. It's like, no, you won't. Because your human brain can't understand things beyond human.
I like to think cease to be human. Some of the worst chambers of hell are reserved for transhumanists and luxury space communist types. I honestly think that just they deserve the worst levels of hell. You know, just
they would quite literally surrender their humanity for a slightly less, for a slightly shorter queue. Mm-hmm. You know, for a millisecond quicker Starbucks.
They can have a soy milkshake sent to their house. Three minutes, than we do it now, you know.
Elon Musk is going to set up a based Twitter, but the only way you get in is if you tweet using your Neuralink and you literally post your thoughts online.
Oh no. Yeah. The message got redacted. I'm not sure why, but HS in the chat asked us if we'd ever shot any kind of firearms.
I have.
I think we all have.
Before COVID, I used to go shooting all the time. And I'll tell you what's even more fun than hunting with a shotgun is fox hunting with hounds and horse. That's if you want some
way to piss off the libs as well.
Yeah, like,
people will foam at the mouth.
They really hate. I mean, it's like, but the people that hate it all live in the city and they go to universities. They don't actually live in the cut. They've never seen. They've never had that countryside experience of waking up in the morning and seeing a trail of blood leading out of your hen house or your sheep pen, and then just mutilated animals all over the place. Like once you've seen that, you can fox hunt as much as you want. There'll never be a moral quandary to killing fox after that.
It's like the horrendous overpopulation of badgers we've got, and we're not even allowed to manage the countryside anymore.
No.
Because people get upset because you're shooting like actual environmental pests.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like all the people getting upset that they have to hunt elephants now because there's too many. Like the conservation efforts were too successful, and they're literally rampaging, destroying huge parts of the countryside in parts of Africa because there's too many elephants because they have no actual predators. but yes, I've done the least of my shooting in Britain. Really, I've done quite a bit when I've been in the US, and I've also every time I've been to Eastern Europe, I've been shooting. I'm probably on some kind of list because I underwent quite a few years ago a little bit of firearms training in Serbia.
This is a bit of deep lore. Are you in training for the militia?
No, I like Eastern Europe's a good cheap holiday. So I've been to the Ukraine before. Which is why I find the current discourse so tragic, because not many people have actually been there. I actually went as a tourist in about 2010 to Chernobyl, with a proper guide system, and I had a good time there. That's how I know that Ukraine is basically an open arms dump, and the idea that we need to pump weapons in there is ridiculous.
It's like no one's seen the Nick Cage classic Lords of War.
Yes.
I
like that film very much.
I had a very famous trip to the range in 2018 in America, that resulted in the closure of CalArts. But we don't talk about that one.
Oh.
But yes, to sum up, everyone here has had a probably far higher than average degree of range time than most British people. For a British stream, we are quite well trained.
Probably enough of that chat.
Yes, there's enough of that. We have one more super chat before we kind of come to a rounding out of the stream here. Glowy donated another $2 and said, an abstraction with no grounding will not work in reality. Liberalism has become an abstraction of abstraction. We assert this thing. Why? Because it's right. Why is it right? Something we are born with. You know, basically he's saying it's good because it's right, because it's good, because it's liberal, because it's right, because it's good.
Yes,
which is the situation we found ourselves in. S. Smith donated $5. He said, great story from NL. I'm not sure where that's from. Certain conservationists preferred large wild cattle in a nature reserve starving to death over culling them because that would be nice. I'm not sure NL... I'm not sure what that is, but that tends to be the case. There is very bad management. The worst people to manage natural environments are environmentalists because they don't understand the cycle of life and death.
No, they have. Well, again, there's a brilliant piece of writing by my patron saint, Joseph de Maistre, where he goes on this kind of very violent rant about the fact that all life is this kind of bloody struggle between species, you know? Like, he makes this point about how, you know, man needs clothes, so he has to, you know, cut open the throats of animals and tear off their skins to clothe himself. He takes out their organs to feed himself. He tears the guts out of animals and then makes like cello strings out of them for music, you know? Like, and then you look at nature, it's just animals killing each other constantly in a kind of systematic way and in an environment that sustains that. And he says, this is what life is. This is the demonstrable truth of life, and we can't hide from that. You know, it's built on an altar of blood in a sense. And he of course takes us to its philosophical conclusion. He says, because of course he's writing immediately after the revolution has just happened in France and everything is washed with blood, and he's saying, you know, this is the punishment of God for upsetting the natural order. You know, that we think we're above the kind of the reality of life being so kind of steeped in blood. But it happens to us too, and it will happen. You know, we can't escape that. You know, lives will be we pay with our lives for such heresies.
Well, no, that's a point that Kuhnelt Leyden touches on it several times. I mean, he essentially states that given the spread of ideas like humanism and atheism, that any sort of mass governing body is eventually just going to have to build itself on blood because it will run out of everything else. And that almost in a sort of sense that like the last ditch move for all political organizations is some form of genocide. I think really one last thing I think I'd want to touch on as we're sort of closing the stream is just the I know I've kind of mentioned it a few times, just the complete and utter ignorance and the really shoddy way that liberalism is dealt with from the right by so many people. I mean, I think there should be no forgiveness for it, but there should be no excuses for it anyway. So much of what, you know, people just turn around and be like, well, civil rights is liberalism. Well, it's not actually. Because if you understand the tradition of liberalism and how it functioned in the world, civil rights is completely anathema to the way that it functioned. And I don't understand why it seems like people who really should know better will just always fall for that stuff. I don't know if they're doing it because it's just easy or because they genuinely just don't know.
It's part of the issue of hyper-reality. They don't actually have any kind of proper grasp of the way life is because they've not been educated properly.
Mm.
They've not been taught. Because, I mean, so one of the... a project that... Ferro and I and some others have been talking about is, of course, because of course some of us have had children, some of us are going to have children soon, and we're talking about kind of how to educate children in the modern world. And one of the issues is that modern education doesn't educate you. It does the opposite. It removes your ability to think critically about anything. That's why the normie problem is so severe, and the fact that even kind of high level university types just have these kind of NPC normie brains where they just toe a line and never think realistically about anything. And part of the reason we think this is because back in the day, you would have been educated. One of the first things you would have been taught was the ancient Greek tragedies and the Bible. And of course, what those two things teach you is basically a very anti-humanist, cynical, but ultimately correct view of what mankind is and how man interacts with itself. And of course, what that means is that you would go on to be able to engage with reality as it stands. But of course, now you're not taught any of that. You're just taught, abstractions in a sense. You're just taught kind of facts that don't lend themselves to anything. You're never actually made to think in any meaningful way, and as such, you come out worse off, I think, than if you had not gone to school. I mean, you know that meme about the IQ curve, where you've got the extremely stupid man on one end and the extremely clever man on the other. You know, but then they're fundamentally aligned. The man with no schooling and the man with the best schooling both basically believe the same thing. It's the kind of midwit in the middle that insists on all these kind of liberal falsities, you know? Because I think that ultimately the best education, all it does is confirm natural human prejudices. That's actually all it really does. So yeah,
that's that. I'll put it in the chat there. But we have made memes, our own memes of this, because we did have a big dunk on the horseshoe theory. Mm. So it's the whole like good things are good and bad things are bad.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Like, well, how do you define that? It's like what I think is good, what I think is bad is bad. It's like you can't really get around that subjective nature of how humans think.
No,
to pretend to be able to abstract yourself out of that is to undergo a large like process of self-delusion. You might as well maximize what you think is good and minimize what you think is bad. And you should never like apologize for doing that process, because it's how you interact with the world. And to not do that is to surrender to other people and their ideas and the false neutrality. That's really how you end up with that. Yeah, the education system is an important aspect of that, because you end up again with people thinking that there is the neutral position, when, you know, to adopt the postmodern position, which in that sense is correct, that there is no objective politics. There is no, you know, when it comes to human organization, there is no objective ethics without God or without the deification of nature.
Man is not enough.
Well, see, yeah, I was going to say that's why we no longer have our liberalism that worships God. Liberalism ended up just worshipping man in the form of democracy. If that's even fair to say that it carried on in the tradition, which I don't think it did. I think as soon as you separate the metaphysical aspect of God and try and patchwork in some notion of the people or popular sovereignty or, you know, any sense of universalism that isn't metaphysical in that sense, that it's a complete and utter failure just waiting to happen. I mean, so it's someone in the chat saying Elderman or whatever, at some point Sargon needs to be brought up in this idea of England as a Protestant nation. Its foundations and great institutions are Catholic. No, exactly. He has to have this historionic view of Britain as Protestant Britain and Protestant England.
British exceptionalism.
Yeah, I
not just for that, not just for that sense of exceptionalism and nationalism, but because then he gets to look at it as a singular people that would necessitate a system of democracy. I mean, I think, I know that there was that complete shit show that happened on AA's stream at one point where he basically sperged at Charlemagne for like 2 hours and he just left. But I think I think it would be funny just to like pin him down on a debate at one point, or like, how can you reconcile your position as someone who is A, right wing, or at least not left wing, and B, a liberal, with your complete and utter, what seems like adulation for democratic governance?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, this is a point I raised to him on a stream we did with AM.
I remember that one as well. I don't think he ever addressed it at any
check.
No, it's still loading.
Connect stream software to start a preview. Oh, there we go. I think it might be back.
Well, OBS is still streaming.
I can see it on the back end. Yeah. We're still going. We're up. So
yeah.
Let us. Sorry about that, guys. We had a slight internet dropout.
Yeah. Straight back to it then. Yes. You were saying you had this argument with the liberal types for years.
Yes.
Yeah.
I've had this discussion for years with people. And the problem is, again, you can lead the horse to water, but you can't make it drink.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens is that you might be able to cajole and poke them into agreeing with you in the moment. You might be able to beat them with the undeniable logic that the will of one person shouldn't dictate the will of the other. That's just, you know, unless someone is in a community or a family with someone, then the will of someone thousands, you know, hundreds or thousands of miles away shouldn't affect, you know, the choices of somebody else. That is pure, pure imposition. It's you know, purely immoral.
Well, I
but then when asked if they support democracy, they go, well, of course, you know, it's the best system.
I don't even necessarily think it's that. It's more so trying to get to the realist sort of position of, you know, if you can get them to agree that someone must rule, then why will they not agree to having someone who at least rules in earnest? And that functionally, the whole concept of collective sovereignty or group sovereignty doesn't work, because you cannot have as many as 100 or, you know, sorry, as many as 1,000 or even 100 minds really singularly agree on anything, because it's just not how humans work.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I raised the point to him as well that, well, that you look, man has to be governed in some way. And there are certain truths and certain hard facts about power. And we can either ignore those and suffer, or we can ennoble them and work with them and live in accord with them. And to me, that's what, for example, say, early European feudalism was. It was a society in accordance with the nature of human society and the will of God. And I pointed out that, well, you know, let's rewind even to say like 1500 England. Your local power, the power to whom you account locally, will be your local baron, say, or your local earl, and you'll know who that person is. You'll know things about them. You'll have spoken to them. You'll have seen them in the street every day. You'll have an engagement with them. And I said that, well, of course, this means that they're close enough that you can punch them. You know, if in comparison to this bizarre system where you might elect a local MP who then goes off to London, and you know, we all know, let's not even pretend that parliamentarianism or congressional systems are really about local representation at all, because they aren't. No member of parliament, for example, has ever really had local interests at heart, unless he literally lives there and has established interests there, you know, and cares for that community in some way. Which in most cases it doesn't work like that. You just get an MP parachuted from the party, you know. That's it. We need to stop, or they need to stop, believing in these fictions about the nature of power and the nature of parliamentarianism, and they need to stop pushing towards a centralized state. Because as you say, these stupid ideas like, you know, man or the people is sovereign or whatever, all this does is pull you towards centralized populist Napoleonic dictatorships. You know, that's all it's ever going to do.
I think we can probably round out there then. We were pretty much towards the end of the stream when that slight hiccup happened anyway, so it's not afraid there's too much.
I will ask, are you able to end the stream on your end?
Yes,
from
I
YouTube?
Am.
Because I can't. The Windows
I'm able
like,
to
still
end
crashed.
It from
right, cool.
No. I'm able to end the stream from here. But thank you for coming. Panama Hat's channel is linked to the description. Is there anything you want to shill before we go?
No. As they said, my channel's in the description. You can tip me on Ko-fi. The links are all there in my videos and stuff. Very much appreciated. No, that's it. I'll have some books coming out later this year, and I'll give more info when they're about to happen.
Oh, I was going to say, do you not also have possibly in the works some kind of semi-regular publication that you may be working on?
That's still very much in the planning stages. So I don't want to say too much about that. But yes, we're trying to pull together a kind of right-wing journal, you know, with sort of essays and poems and fictions and things. All in it, and that's that sort of stuff. Just an actual kind of paper record of this community, if you will.
Go on. I was going to say, I put it in the chat. We've also got the Substack talking about paper records, or at least digital paper records of things. Mm. That is where you can find mine and Evelyn's writing. And I've been putting stuff up there more regularly. You have a Substack as well, don't you, Panama Hat?
I do, and there will be content on it soon. There's only one essay up at the moment, but there'll be more.
Okay. Just double checking we've shilled everything we need to shill. Apart from that, we'll keep doing these regular Monday and Thursday streams when we can. They may not be a Thursday stream this week because I'll probably be in transit, but we'll see if I can maybe get a video together over the next couple of weeks. I'll be recording with a couple of people, I think, probably on the 23rd onwards. I might have some actual midweek videos to put out because I'll be recording with somebody, hopefully not getting the channel banned, from the 3D printed firearms community. So that should be an interesting and hopefully not too Fed posty one. And I may or may not have another guest, but that's yet to be seen. Because I've had a
sorry, when you go. Sorry.
I was going to say, thank you guys for listening.
Oh, I don't know if we're going to close off. Oh, no.
What's happened?
What? Have you finished?
Yes, I've not ended the stream yet, no.
All right.
I was waiting for you guys to say goodbye.
No, I was just going to quickly say there might be a stream on Monday. I've got some essays opened in tabs somewhere that I may look at for doing one of those. I think we've got a decent stream planned for next Thursday. And then the Monday after, which would be a slightly later stream, however, will be with Radlib, which I think should be rather good as well. Hopefully something a bit like this, where we sort of sit down and actually hash out some form of central idea or issue for a couple hours.
Yes, I did see a couple of super chats come in the last couple of minutes, but I'll answer those next time. Anyway, I'll say goodbye from me. You guys want to say goodbye?
Goodbye, everybody. Thanks for listening.
There we go.